This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ranchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this final show of 2023. And it's been a very interesting year. And like every other show, we're going to recap some of the topics that we discussed over the course of the past year that were of special interest, not only to me, but many of our listeners who I've heard from. In the second half of today's program, we're going to rebroadcast an interview I did with Dr. M. Lisa Atterbury. Dr. Atterbury was discussing with us and discussed breast surgery, and she is a breast surgical oncologist at St. Francis Hospital, and she's also in Southbury, Connecticut. So she works primarily, I said St. Francis Hospital, I meant Trinity Health of New England, because she is at St. Mary's. So we spent a lot of time with her chatting about current treatments, both surgical and medical, for breast cancer. And we're going to replay that interview in the second half of today's program. One of the things, you know, everybody seems to like is every show I try to do something about this day in medicine. And it's been very interesting for me because it opens up new topics every day that we look at this. And today's topic is even more fascinating. And that is in December 30th, 1907, Dr. William Randolph Lovelace was born. I've never heard of Dr. Lovelace before until I looked this up. But he was one of the people who selected the first American astronauts back in 1958 for Project Mercury. It's interesting because he spent a lot of his time in the military. He was a Harvard graduate, trained at Bellevue in New York, and really always had this propensity for flight medicine, and was really one of the fathers of aerospace medicine. And his interest was high altitude flight and the physiologic effects of that. He designed one of the early oxygen masks that pilots use at high altitude. So it was interesting. But one of the stories I found especially interesting was he had a belief that women were better suited for high altitude flight. Then he had a list of physiologic reasons for this. So he set out along with another physiologist and pilot, and both of them went out and trained a group of women to participate in the aerospace program. And it was amazing because they went through all the same training that the men did. They had to have an advanced college degree. They had to have more than 2 hours of flight time, including high altitude flight time. And he put them through all this training. And then when it came time for them to go to Pensacola to begin actual flights and preparation for the astronaut program, the Navy blocked it and wouldn't allow them access. So it's interesting because we have these innate historical prejudices, shall we say. I mean, and that really held us back because, as we found, women are an essential part of the aerospace program today. But in 1958, they only selected men. And it wasn't until the 1980s that we had female astronauts, even though we may have been able to progress further sooner had somebody not had this prejudice against women at that time. So with that, this day in medicine, we remember the day Dr. William Randolph Lovelace was born, a name that I've never been familiar with, but certainly someone who has contributed a great deal to our country and our space program. Among some of the topics I wanted to touch on today are some of the things I spend a lot of time talking about on this program. We've spent a lot of time talking about vaccinations and the importance of vaccinations and the importance of making sure that our children and grandchildren are vaccinated. It's absolutely crucial, not just for COVID. COVID taught us something, right? And if any of us are sitting here thinking that's never going to happen again, you're mistaken, okay? Because we also thought that about terrorist attacks, okay? We thought that about mass shootings. Well, that was a one-time event. And now they've become absolutely commonplace. Vaccination is the key here. And no advancement in medicine has saved more lives than vaccination. Another topic we spent a lot of time with was dementia. Causes of dementia, what can be done about dementia. And one of the interviews we did, I thought was especially interesting with Dr. Salvatore Napoli. Now, Dr. Napoli is a guest on our program talking about multiple sclerosis. He is a specialist in multiple sclerosis. And we know that's an inflammatory disease affecting the central nervous system. But what was interesting in our discussion is that his interests have really branched into the area of dementia at his clinic where he works in Foxborough, Massachusetts. And he has really built and developed what is really one of the foremost and most interesting groups there, because he mixes so many different specialties together in his group, including neuropsychology and dementia. And the interesting thing I took from that interview was the fact that the field of dementia and treatment of dementia is now moving in parallel a great deal with the field of multiple sclerosis. In the early days of multiple sclerosis, all we had, in the early days of treatment, all we had were intravenous treatment, intravenous infusions, much like we have for dementia now. So with that, it's just interesting to get his take on it. It's going to be something great for us to follow as we move forward. The other thing we spent time with that I thought was interesting and is always interesting is how do we pay for health care in America? And the huge number of mistakes we've made. We're paying more than any other country in the world, and we have the worst results in terms of longevity than any other industrialized nation in the world. That's got to tell us we're doing something wrong. So there are several different things. We have Medicare in this country. We have Medicare that's administered by the government, the standard Medicare, as we call it. And then there's managed Medicare. And I never really anticipated that so many people have moved to managed Medicare programs. In fact, managed Medicare is outpacing standard Medicare right now. And that's because what has happened is private entities have taken the money they get from Medicare and used them more judiciously. They've invested in keeping you healthy rather than always taking care of you when you're sick. Now, part of that has also come down to the fact that they have much more restrictive networks in terms of who you can see and where you can get your surgery done and things such as that. But it's really made a difference, and I think we need to be moving more to a system such as that for everyone, where paying for insurance is not the obligation of your employer, but it is the obligation of the government to whom your employer and all of us are paying taxes. So I'm hoping we see some movement in that area. One thing we've seen movement in has been in managing the programs that have come from the Affordable Care Act. Now, many people have dubbed this Obamacare, but he hasn't been the president for a while, and the Affordable Care Act continues to grow. This is a way for people who do not are not qualified or cannot afford to get buy benefits from their employer, or they're self-employed and they have a way of purchasing benefits for what has been considered a reasonable rate, although that rate continues to go up. What I like about this is that it encourages people to go out and do something different. Let me explain. I meet a lot of people who are working not for the joy of their work, not because it's what they're qualified to do. It's because they need the benefits. They get up every morning and drag themselves to a job they don't like, but because they need the health benefits for their family. Many of these people are quite creative and have ways of going out and becoming entrepreneurs, right? The key to a lot of times people are just stifled from being entrepreneurs for something as basic as obtaining health care. It's been my feeling and that of other experts in this area that by providing a universal system of health care, we will be stimulating not just creativity, but our economy. So, and that has been the case in other countries. So it's something that I'm hoping elected officials are not digging in along party lines and trying to see really the fact that this is obvious to everyone, that the current system doesn't work. It's not working for patients. It's not working for providers, those being physicians, nurses. It's not even working for insurance companies, okay? It's certainly not working for the government. So when you have a system that has broken down in so many different areas, it's time to really take a look at it. With that, we're going to take a short break. They're going to be back to talk about some of the things that we've been doing in the past with the idea that it was good for our health. But guess what? We found other information. We have moved on in the field of education, and we're not doing those things anymore. If you have any questions for me, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. I'll be taking questions throughout this first half hour, at least over the next 10 minutes. So just email them over to me, and we'll get them on. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And I guess we'll be hearing that tune quite a bit of Auld Lang Syne. In this segment, I want to talk about some of the things that we thought were good for us and we were advised to do in the past, but education has changed. And we've changed a great deal. A recent situation I had was testifying as an expert in the case, and one of the attorneys for, I guess, the other side said, well, doctor, in 2015, didn't you say this? And doesn't that contradict what you're saying today? And I said, yes, absolutely. Based on what we knew in 2015, that was the truth. But believe me, the field of concussion and head injury is moving along quite a bit. But anyhow, in this case, one of them was moderate drinking, right? So people were told that if you drank to some moderation, it would protect you from heart disease. And specifically, they would say like a glass of red wine every day would have enough elements in it to not only avoid heart disease, but dementia. And lead to a longer life. This was in the 1980s. A recent British study that looked at this looked at 5 million people. And what they did was they looked at people who had low levels of drinking. So these were not alcoholics. They were people who were following what they thought was a good health practice of one or two drinks per day. And when they looked at this large population, 5 million people, and compared them to people who did not drink at all, the people who drank had an increased risk of death. So not only didn't protect you, but you had an increased risk of death. So again, the idea of one drink a day, we're not doing that anymore. Obviously, less is better than drinking to excess, but not drinking and abstaining from alcohol, it seems to be the best medical advice at the current time. The other thing was something I did. When I was 35, quite a few, some 34 years ago, I found that most doctors, like when you polled doctors and went to big medical meetings, most doctors were taking low-dose aspirin. And it was because we felt at that time that that clearly affected avoiding stroke and heart attack. You could avoid stroke and heart attack by taking an 81 milligram enterocoated aspirin every day. And I did it for probably the next 30 or more years. But another study was done. The aspirin for reducing events in elderly, the ASPRE study. And what they did was they found that low-dose aspirin does not prevent stroke in healthy people who are over the age of 70. So, and specifically, the study was designed because that was the population it was felt to help the most, was the group over 70. We knew it didn't help the group under 70 from other studies that were done. So we found that taking an aspirin every day did not avoid heart attack and stroke. And I subsequently changed my own personal habits in that regard. This next thing was the talk of vitamin D supplements preventing bone fractures in children. Now, I don't want to get this confused with people with osteoporosis. Men and women with osteoporosis need to take vitamin D supplementation. But this study was interesting because we always think that in children, taking extra vitamin D would help them avoid fractures. So they looked at school children in a town in Mongolia, where they found that decreased vitamin D and low calcium intake was widespread in this large population. So they actually looked at 8,800 school children between the ages of 6 and 13. And of these, 95% of them were clearly defined as being low. So they took half of the group they gave a supplement to, and a half they took placebo. So again, this is the best type of study you can do, right? Because there's blinding. You don't know what you're taking. You don't know if you're taking a supplement or the placebo. And they followed these children for 3 years and found that those taking the vitamin D supplement had the same rate of bone fractures as those who did not take the vitamin D supplement. So again, this idea of hypervitaminosis and taking a lot of vitamin D in children. And it gets back to the thought of find a good primary care doctor and take their advice. Hard to find these days, right? And we spoke with Dr. Robitaille and from St. Francis Hospital a little bit about that there are physicians available, and you really need to, before you start engaging in some behaviors when it comes to your health, that's what your doctor is for. So everyone should really establish themselves with a primary care physician, and if none are available, an alternative advanced practice practitioner to work with that, either an APRN or a physician assistant, so that you can go to them for good basic advice that's scientifically based. With that, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back. I'm going to talk a little introduction of our guest, and we're going to be talking with Dr. M. Lisa Atterbury, and she is a specialist in breast surgical oncology. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WCIC News Talk 1080.
As the bells ring out, everyone will shout, Happy New Year!
We're back on Healthy Rounds. We're going to be playing the interview we did previously with Dr. M. Lisa Atterbury. Dr. Atterbury is a fellowship-trained breast surgical oncologist and also specializes in breast reconstruction in Southbury, Connecticut, and she operates at St. Mary's Hospital. I wanted to bring this back because breast cancer is such a huge problem. 1 in 8 women in this country will have breast cancer. I dare say that I don't think anyone listening to this program doesn't know somebody with breast cancer who has suffered from breast cancer. So with that, let's hear from Dr. Atterbury, and then I'll be back to wrap things up. But I felt this was just such an important and informative interview that I wanted to replay it today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be on it, and especially for Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
So let's talk a little bit about breast cancer. Where are we? Are we winning the fight?
I think we are. We have a long way to go. I think there's been major advances with molecular DNA mapping. That's really changed how we treat these patients. And you're kind of seeing the gamut switch from a lethal disease, and it still is in some certain sense, but a lot of people are living with metastatic breast cancer just like they would diabetes or hypertension because our treatment modalities have gotten so much better, as our diagnostic as well.
Really? I mean, that even surprises me in terms of metastatic disease. Now, let's talk about the types of breast cancer and how, because I always think about, you know, the people who have survived are because it's localized to the breast only, didn't go to lymph nodes and things such as that. So can you please educate us all, including me, about how we're dealing with all the different types?
So look, that's a loaded question, Tony. So if you break it down, 60-80% of cancers are ductal in origin, just because okay. that's the major anatomy of the breast. You have about 10-15% are lobular, and then you have outliers, Paget's disease, inflammatory, other things. But when you get to the subsets, each breast cancer has its own unique DNA. You know, where there's certain things that we test for, whether a tumor is sensitive to estrogen or not. And now with more molecular mapping, which is really the DNA of the tumor. So we were always used to, as physicians, is testing our DNA, right, to see if we're carriers of whatever it may be, Turner syndrome, sure, all that. Now we can take tumors, not all of them, but a lot of them, and look at a DNA panel, and it'll really tell us, you know, what is their risk of recurrence? Isn't it aggressive disease? And if it is, what is the benefit for these individuals of taking chemo, of decreasing their risk of recurrence? What is the benefit for the hormones? So we're really starting to individualize these treatments. And yes, localized disease now is just defined to the axillary lymph nodes. You can have patients with disease in their bones that live 20, 30 years. You know, we've seen patients that have had metastatic disease that, you know, their survival at 5 years used to be 10%. Now we're starting to see that get 20%. And I think we're seeing less of those. We do see those, but we're seeing less because of this type of talk show or people getting out and getting their studies. It's just making people more well. So we're diagnosing a lot earlier. And we now know, believe it or not, we're over-treating. So now we're trying to change the gamut of not only targeting the treatment, which will allow a longer disease-free survival, but not over-treating these patients, which happened in the past with, you know, chemotherapy was always the standard, and now it's changing. Molecular therapy, Keytruda, Verzenio, all these new immunotherapies are really just changing the game.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because I'm a big fan of personalized medicine and knowing the DNA and knowing the specifics about your tumor. So, and let's look at, with immunotherapy, for people listening, do they still have the same side effects as the what we would call traditional chemotherapy? Because people, when they hear the word chemotherapy, I saw a patient this week, and she had breast cancer. She's been going through this battle, and she had pretty much localized disease, no lymph nodes, but her doctor said she'd have to have chemotherapy and radiation. She suggested chemotherapy and radiation, and she said, I'm just not doing the chemotherapy. And I said, why? And she said, listen, I don't want to go through that. I don't want my hair falling out. I don't want all these other side effects. With immunotherapy, are you still seeing those same side effects that we would see with traditional chemotherapy?
We are not. We are definitely not. You know, the traditional chemotherapy and your patient, it's hard to say what type of disease she had. But
sure.
You know, chemotherapy is really good at killing cells that are rapidly dividing or growing, which are cancer cells. However, it attacks healthy cells. So it kind of takes everyone when it goes into the body. Now, with the immunotherapy, if you look at Keytruda has been out for quite a while. You know, they don't have the same side effects. They're very targeted therapy, and there are probably people walking around you right now that are on Keytruda, Kadcyla, any of those medications, with no side effects. It's very targeted down to the molecular level of these tumors. And so instead of being, you know, hitting everything, you know, the hair loss, right? They get the burns in the mouth kind of component.
Sure.
They get the peripheral neuropathy, as you know, personally.
That's what I see them for, right.
Yeah, the peripheral neuropathy from the platinums, absolutely, and the taxanes. We don't see that. I mean, they're walking around, and, you know, I have a patient right now who just saw me. She has a local recurrence after 1 year. She's in her late 70s, a little frail, but started Ibrance and has been on it for 2 months, and she's going about her normal life like nothing. Now, there are some people that if you read the literature, there's always somebody, right, Tony? There's, you know, an instance of colitis. You know, if you look at aspirin, you know, aspirin should probably a black box warning now with all the side effects, but we don't see that now with these medications. It really has flipped. You know, we've taken a lot from the autoimmune community, and now, you know, translating it over into cancers and, you know, lung cancer, melanoma, breast cancer, you know, prostate, they're doing molecular mapping, colon as well. So you really have to change that mindset of people think of chemotherapy of, you know, that person who's a skeleton, they can't eat, they have hair loss, you know, they look like they're almost on the deathbed. And honestly, sometimes with chemo, that's how it goes. It doesn't look good. Very different picture now, as you see.
Let's shift over. You mentioned about prevention and people going out and getting their studies. And typically, I think that means mammography. And we are constantly going through this, I don't know, revolt about when to get mammography, when the USPSTF tell us. And the New England Journal of Medicine just published a perspective of a dissenting view. So It's confusing for physicians. It's got to be confusing for the public. Can you give us your perspective on when should women be getting mammograms?
Absolutely. So that is definitely a moving target. In the mid 2015, 2016, there was a government study that came out and said, you know, every other year for mammograms starting at 45, well, we saw a huge escalation of missed breast cancers.
Right.
So the American Society of Breast Surgeons in 2019 put out a statement, which American Cancer Society just kind of adopted part of it, saying, really, with no risk factors, nobody, family history, you haven't been deemed to be high risk, 40 is your time to get your mammogram. And it's yearly thereafter, unless your life expectancy drops to less than 10 years. So that's kind of where we sit. The American Cancer Society just came out with a statement of saying, well, every year till 50 and then every other year. And that's, you don't want to be in that situation because the most common age of diagnosis for a female is 62. So women are 62 and men are 71. You know, everybody thinks it's always these young people, like it's 30s and they're a small subset. They just get a lot of publicity, but really 62 is the average age. And so the American Society of Breast Surgeons, which, you know, for myself is what we follow, is really it's 40 every year, you know, unless something dramatically changes. You know, if I have somebody who's, I might have a patient who's 80 years of age and she's healthier than a 50-year-old, then I'm like, keep getting your mammograms. So that's kind of where we sit for all comers. Now, when you have high risk, that gets a little bit different. Are they genetically? Do they carry a genetic mutation? You know, then some of the recommendations are starting MRIs at the age of 25 because mammograms aren't great for that subset of population because of their dense breast tissue. Now, if you just have somebody who's high risk, you know, maybe a mother had breast cancer, their aunt, their father, you know, men get breast cancer as well. You know, that may put them in a high risk category where we alternate a mammogram and MRI every 6 months to follow them. So that's where we kind of sit on the basics. It can get a little bit different based on their mutations that they have, but really 40 is our recommendation, unless something changes, family history, their personal history, yearly thereafter, unless, you know, they do have a life expectancy, all of a sudden it becomes less than 10 years. And that's a consideration. That's also a conversation to have with the patient as well, you know, and so it's not like a mandate. I don't think anybody can mandate that. We have these conversations every day, but that's where the American Society of Breast Surgeons sits. I think that's a very good policy given the fact that the average age is 62.
Let's get into surgery. What are the types of surgery? I remember as a medical student way back in the 70s that we were dealing with radical mastectomies that were huge operations done, and obviously things have changed a lot since that time. So can you talk a little bit about the surgical options for someone with breast cancer? And I know there's a wide array of them, so if you can
sure.
help us with that.
I'll try my best. And so up until the 80s, every female had a mastectomy because that was the standard, like you said, the Halsted.
Yep.
In the late 80s, they started looking at more breast conservation, meaning a lumpectomy. And through studies, they determined that a lumpectomy with radiation is equal in survival to a mastectomy. So the only true benefit for a mastectomy, and that holds through today, is really risk reduction. So you have those coming now where breast conservation, mastectomy. So if you start with mastectomies, you know, the Halsted mastectomy was horrible. Pectoralis, the chest muscle was gone, the deformities are gone, lymphedema, that irreversible swelling, massive. We're now to the point where I think I came out in practice in 2006. And so we were kind of in Philadelphia. I talked Dr. Tom Frazier, who was my fellowship director, he was kind of pushing. And so I started doing nipple sparing mastectomies. And we took a lot of heat from societies. And now that's the standard. So if you can, you could possibly try to preserve the nipple in doing these mastectomies. And which is a game changer, right? It looks like you've almost just deflated the breast tissue and have that natural skin and nipple areola complex. The risk of recurrence is the exact same of the old mastectomies. So if you can't do nipple sparing, you know, there's other ways to reconstruct. And so with the mastectomies, you know, now since 2017, we're doing direct implants. And it used to be, you know, you do a mastectomy, you know, plus or minus the lymph nodes, and then you would put a tissue expander in, which kind of looks like a flat balloon. You'd put it behind the muscle and slowly expand that pocket to give you, you know, the illusion that there's breast tissue there. And then 8 months later, depending on what the treatment, then they would go back for another procedure and get an implant. Well, everything kind of changed pretty dramatically in 2017, 2018, where it can really be a one-stage procedure in the right environment. So a patient can come in, have mastectomies, direct implants, and this state is a little different. You know, you have the no drive-by mastectomy. That doesn't quite, I've never heard of it until I moved here, but, you know, I would send my patients home after.
I don't even know what that is. So
somewhere in the literature and politically driven, somebody thought that, you know, sending patients home the day of a mastectomy was just, you know, unfair and, you know, cruel. And so in your state, you actually have to keep a patient overnight for a mastectomy, which I've been in practice for 17 years and rarely have I kept a patient overnight. I mean, now they don't really have pain. They go home, they have drains, but most of the time they go home that day and it's a nice one-stage procedure. The challenging part is really getting patients to buy in because there is a 6 to 8 week period where they have to kind of settle down. And so that's really important. Complication rate can be higher, but that's a big changer from that part. When you look at a lumpectomy, really up until like 2018, you know, and when it started, if you had an abnormal mammogram and you had a biopsy, there was a clip left in there if there was not a palpable lesion. So their surgery if you test the lymph nodes. And so, Tony, I know you're aware, but, you know, underneath the arm, there's 30 to 40 lymph nodes. We really target the sentinel nodes. So the sentinel nodes, I always say, are just the gatekeepers, are the first lymph nodes that are going to receive infection or cancer. So we want to keep that dissection less than four. And so up until 2019, the way it would go would, if you were doing a lumpectomy, the patient would come into the hospital, they would check in, they would have to go to radiology. And then while they're awake, there's a guide wire, a wire put into their breast down to that clip. Not the most comfortable thing. And then while they were down there, they would go to radiology, nuclear med, and get a radionucleotide injected to help us identify the lymph nodes. Then they would come up to surgery. There's a chance of that needle being dislodged. So you get that all together, you take it back to the operating room. You know, we inject like a blue dye, and so you would take these lymph nodes out based on the radioactive count, which, as you and I both know, radioactive is not great. Who knows what's going to be, what we're going to be like in 30 years. But not only that, is that guide wire would shift all over the place. So it was a truly traumatic experience for these patients. It's a four-hour delay for a surgeon and OR, but more importantly, the patients hated it. So in 2018, Centamag, which is by Ethicon, I happened to meet the right person at the right time where we were able to get rid of all that. And so I can do a biopsy in the office. I can drop a mag seed, which is just a tiny magnet. It is about a grain of salt.
Is this the MagTrace technology?
This is part of the MagTrace. The MagTrace is the liquid magnet we inject instead of the radionucleotide. So that can be injected in the office or pre-op. So you have this little, it's basically all magnetic. That's ionized mag. That's all it is. So you can either inject it if you drop that mag seed in the office, or that will stay for almost, depending on the literature, you can probably do it almost 9 months out of seeing it. So someone has to go through chemo. You can still find that place where the cancer was. So patients now come in and they don't have an idea now, unless I've had a patient who's had a needle loc and pass. And that's the first thing they kind of hit me with. Like, I hated the wire. It was painful. I didn't want to do it. And so now you drop these in there, you know, you numb up the breast, you drop the mag seed in there, and the pre-op area in your office, you numb up the breast and liquid magnet, the mag tracer. You go right to the operating room. You have a probe that helps you identify specifically underneath the arm. The sensitivity and specificity for the mag tracer identifying lymph nodes is about 97 to 98%. Pretty accurate. Small little incision. Yeah, we like to keep the lymph nodes to less than four to keep that lymphedema rate very, very low. And then you can put the probe right on the breast while the patient's asleep, target down. You can use an ultrasound, remove that lesion, and you're done and over. And so patients are not traumatized. They're not, you know, traveling across the street, which happens in many areas, you know. Sure. It's a game changer. And honestly, from the 80s when it started, Tony, this has really been the first major advance in partial, you know, breast conservation and trying to get that to be standard so that everyone can experience it. So we've been able to bring that to St. Mary's. And patients, I mean, my patients have been using it since 2019. They love it. You know, when they hear about this guide wire, they think it's barbaric. And in my mind, it is barbaric. So the direct implants, the mag tracer, mag seed, Centamag, those are really big game changers of, you know, keeping individuals' quality of life moving, keeping the trauma less. You know, breast cancer isn't like a physical emergency, but it is a mental emergency. And, you know, it's very high profile. So the less trauma you can give the patient, the better. And getting them back to a normal life, it's a total game changer with it.
Breast reconstruction has obviously become very popular now. And I think you're saying in some cases you do the reconstruction at the same time as the mastectomy or the lumpectomy?
You can do both. If you do a lumpectomy, if someone's very large-breasted, they may opt for breast reduction at the same time. You know, the radiation oncologist would proceed on. So sometimes you have defects from taking out breast tissue that, you know, it's called oncoplastics, where you can move some tissue around. But yes, if patients are doing mastectomy and they're the right candidate, you know, they're not a smoker, you know, they're going to be compliant, absolutely. You can do mastectomies at that stage and put the implants in. And the implants are wrapped in a special type of mesh that's a cadaver mesh, believe it or not. You could drop it in dirt and it will not become infected. The military has been using it for 20 years. You kind of wrap that implant in it, you put it in that pocket, and they go home one stage. I mean, it's a huge change versus, you know, these 6 month of tissue expanders or, you know, the whole trauma of it. You know, before they had such pain because you were putting the implants or the expanders behind the muscle. Patients hated you, which was kind of good because they were behaving. But now they go home and they have no pain, which is now the challenge, right? You know, patients with no pain, they like, I'll just go out and pick up my kids. Yeah, but they can do it one stage, which is, you know, it's a great option to have for those select patients.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, I want to thank you. Thank you for your time today. And really thank you for all you do for women with breast cancer, and I should say men, although a minority group. With breast cancer. For people who wish to get in touch with Dr. Atterbury, the phone number is area code 203-709-8662, and she's in Southbury. Lisa, thanks again for your time.
All right, Tony, you too. Take care. It was a pleasure.
Take care. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
You're midnight, but I'll be cleaning up bottles with you on New Year's.
We're back on Healthy Rounds.
Hold on.
And thank you for joining us today in this last show of the new year. We're wrapping up. We wrapped up actually in November our 14th season here on WTIC. And it's really been great to be with all of you. And especially those of you who email me regularly, I want to thank you. I've gotten New Year's wishes as well from you, and I wish you all a very happy New Year. Next week, we're going to have an interview with Dr. Rachel Geller. We're going to replay that interview. I'll have a new introduction, but I'm going to be on the road with the Professional Bull Riders Tour, who will be in New York at Madison Square Garden. And that's a time where we do baseline physicals on bull riders. So I'll be busy there, but we'll have a show ready for you. And I really want to replay that interview with Dr. Geller. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Corza has been on the board today, as he is always. And Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next up on WTIC is attorney John Matulis with legal advice for all of you. Until next week and until next year, I wish you all a very happy and safe New Year.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.